This is Clinical Conversations. Last December, the clinical world received a set of guidelines on hypertension. The pressures that would qualify a patient as having the condition were lowered to what might have been considered high normal previously, and the number of patients who would qualify to begin drug treatment greatly increased. A group of researchers immediately took on the task of estimating the size of the new patient population and thinking about the implications for public health of the new guidelines. They published their findings very quickly in an online preprint archive, BioArchive, and then more recently in the BMJ. The senior author of the report, Dr. Harlan Krumholz, is here to discuss it all with us. He's a familiar guest here and the editor-in-chief of NEJM Journal Watch Cardiology. He's also the Heinz Professor of Medicine, among other things, at Yale. Welcome back to Clinical Conversations, Dr. Krumholz.
Hey, Joe. It's a pleasure to be here.
You used nationally representative surveys in both the U.S. and China to come up with estimates of the number of people who would now be called hypertensive. Why was that, like, a convenient sample, or what was?
Yeah, so, you know, these guidelines represented a sea change, you know, with regard to how we thought about and are thinking about blood pressure, and basically leveraging the SPRINT trial, the trial that NIH had conducted, which had looked at, you know, lower targets and had been ended early and showed benefit, including mortality, sort of weighed on this committee. There had been some other studies like the ACCORD study, which had looked particularly in patients with diabetes that had sort of failed to show the benefit of essentially tighter blood pressure control, lower blood pressure levels.
Yeah.
But the committee, you know, was impressed by the SPRINT trial in particular and some of the other epidemiologic information, and so came out with this pronouncement. For us, you know, one of the things we've been thinking about is implementation. We at our place spend a lot of time, we think about generating new knowledge for medicine, but also the new knowledge that's generated or the new recommendations or policies that are implemented, what impact does it have on the ground? You know, what does it mean with regard to people who are, you know, coming in to see their doctors? And so we looked at both in the United States and in China. We've been doing a lot of work in China looking at blood pressure. And we had the benefit of having two very high quality epidemiologic studies that were conducted by the respective governments that had been using similar methodology in order to be able to sample the population and then extrapolate to the entire country's population. And so, you know, this was a sort of unique opportunity to say, so what's the impact of these guidelines? If they were to be adopted fully, if people were to embrace them, and you should know, even in the United States, there are now conflicting guidelines. The ACP hasn't completely bought into this, American College of Physicians. And so there's not a uniformity of opinion, even within our country.
Yeah.
But the question sort of is, what would it mean for the labeling, at least before we even get beyond that, what does it mean for the labeling in these two countries? And to get back to your question, which was, are, you know, why did we pick these two data sets? It's because it just happened to be that they are extremely well done by highly competent groups. And the sampling strategy is very sound so that you can make projections for the entire country. And so that we could investigate this question of, so what's the impact of the guidelines on the prevalence of hypertension and eligibility for treatment?
Okay, so you focused on the people in those two countries between the ages of 45 and 75.
Yeah, we thought it was prudent. I mean, the number of people, you know, the people who are of most interest are people starting to get into middle age, and.
Yeah.
Neither of the databases had, you know, very much information about much older individuals. And I think that for most of us, we realize the evidence in that group is not as strong. And so, you know, this is really sort of the bread and butter people coming into primary care and into cardiology and nephrology practices, you know, who are being treated for hypertension or being evaluated for hypertension. That we were trying to go for that sort of main age group.
And in the United States, the new guidelines would encompass about 2/3 of the people in that age group.
Yeah,
which is a big jump. You estimated that there would be.
Do you mean that the new guidelines? I mean, what we said was in the United States that those new guidelines in that age group would now represent, you know, 63% of the population would be labeled as hypertensive.
Right.
And, I mean, you know, it raises these questions of what's normative anymore, because
Right. Now
you're actually a minority of the population who would be considered normotensive.
Right.
And so the majority of the population is now in this group being labeled with a, you know, a significant risk factor.
I think that's
the issue.
Right. That's an interesting point. You figured that there would be about 15 million people in the U.S. added.
Yeah.
To that label. Yeah.
And I think one of the reasons to pull in China was because the numbers are always jaw-dropping in China,
yes,
you know,
right.
Because now we're talking hundreds of millions of people. It's a smaller percentage still in China, even as they've gone through an epidemiologic transition, and with Western lifestyle spreading and middle class and economic prosperity compared to the past, they're now encountering non-communicable diseases like cardiovascular disease. Risk factors are growing rapidly, but they still haven't quite caught up to us. But in terms of the absolute numbers, I mean, it's just, it's a jaw-dropping number. You know, you get there, I think we said the adoption in China's, you know, labels now over 250 million, I think 266, yes. Yeah. 267 million.
Yeah.
People are just over half the population in that same age group is labeled now as having hypertension.
So the number of people, focusing on the United States, the number of people who would be candidates for treatment almost doubles. Currently, there are about 8 million people who are candidates for treatment, and this would add another 7.5 million, according to your paper.
Right. That's, so, you know, that and let me just say this. You know, you could see this a bunch of different ways. I mean, some people could read this as saying, well, it's an immense opportunity. I mean, look at the vast number of people in our country who are now eligible for treatment under the guidelines. And I think, you know, we this paper wasn't intended to pass judgment as much as it was meant to, I think, humble us about if with the adoption of these guidelines, what's the task ahead if this is really true, and the degree to which we're confident that it's the right thing to do, because it entails a change for vast numbers of people. And the labeling, I don't want to underestimate it. You know, there was a lot of interesting work by an American medical sociologist, David Mechanic, and others many years ago, or at least he described it in his book. He had a very classic book where, you know, it was interesting that the labeling of people with hypertension led to greater absentee rates at work.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, the notion is that hypertension is an asymptomatic condition, but that people feel the burden of a label, like I'm not a well person anymore. I've actually got something.
Yes.
And so, you know, it's this notion. So how do we deal with this? Is this something where it's an aspirational goal for society and we try to encourage diet and lifestyle, but we don't really push into meds aggressively? Or is this something where we're really going to double down on our medication approach? It's a sort of interesting thing. And this is intended to sort of just represent, so what does it mean for the absolute numbers of people? And how should we, as a medical profession, begin to think about this as people come in? I have some ideas about that, but this is a saying, we knew this was big when people said there's a new threshold, but this is really putting real numbers on it. And like, again, particularly in China now, you're talking about massive numbers. The other thing is juxtapose that against the reality, which is even with the old thresholds, we weren't doing as well as we could in this country. In China, almost less than 10% in a recent study we did were under people with hypertension, according to old definitions. Let me say current definitions in China, because they haven't adopted these standards.
Okay.
Were uncontrolled. Huh. So that, you know, in China, catching up to the old standards, you know, they've got a lot of work to do. And so, you know, we've got to again think what our strategy is, because there's a lot to do just to get the highest risk people, the people who are even above. We have met too many people above 160. And, you know, we these people are falling through the cracks and are at extraordinarily high risk. So we've got to interact together. But you know, this was just trying to paint the picture of mm-hmm. what this looks like.
The other thing, in addition to labeling people, the other thing that this new standard does, it puts more people under treatment and therefore at risk for complications of treatment, doesn't it?
And non-compliance. I mean, it adds to the number of medications people are on. I mean, again, you could frame it as this is an immense opportunity to help people do better.
Uh-huh.
You could frame it as also that, you know, we're medicalizing treatment. I mean, maybe we should put antihypertensive medication in the water like we did fluoride and just lower everybody down, you know, more. There was in SPRINT a trade-off. I mean, people did have more adverse events in the lower threshold group. I mean, there was more syncope. There was there were more falls. There were, you know, there were a range of things that occurred more often. Now, on the other hand, in that trial, there was a definitive benefit. I mean, from my point of view, there are so many people with hypertension. I want to see validation. I want to see, like, how certain are we of this benefit? And are there groups that are benefiting more or less? I mean, it always surprises me that a common condition like hypertension, it seems like such a big deal to mount such a large trial, and we wait, you know, years for it to be completed, and yet we've been struggling with this without really new therapies. I mean, we should be able to cycle through comparative effectiveness trials rapidly and learn more. And so, I think this is just saying the stakes are really high in terms of being labeled, more people being treated. You know, how much better is this going to make things, and how do we, you know what the right thing to do is? Meanwhile, I think docs every day are being faced with the decision.
Yeah.
Here you are, your blood pressure is 135 without, you know, should I be pushing it down further? In other words, together, should we be pushing it down further? And that's, I think, remains a conundrum for many, you know, many doctors and patient dyads, you know, trying to figure out where to focus.
So what would you like to see happen? You know, from the standpoint of policy, you mentioned your article mentions in its discussion that the new recommendations aren't firmly rooted in evidence. Do you think?
So first of all, I don't want to impugn the very smart, well-meaning, talented group of people who put together those guidelines. There is evidence, but I think what we were trying to make the point was that there is some conflicting evidence too, and the evidence can be seen in many different ways, as demonstrated by the fact that not all the guidelines now are in concordance.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think we're just trying to make the point, not here was one group that saw it one way, other people are not as eager to make that extrapolation from what evidence currently exists. I mean, I can definitely see how they saw it that way. I can also definitely see how people see it more conservatively and are not quite ready to make the jump.
Yeah.
I think this gives us a perfect opportunity for how you treat patients, which is, I believe the evidence is at this point, and the fact that there are different guidelines means that people have permission. People, now I'm not talking about the doctors, the people have permission to say, I would like to try. I think if there's, you know, if there's some dispute about the right thing, but there is evidence that lowers better, I don't mind giving it a try. See if I tolerate it. It makes sense to me, lowers better. Yeah. I'm willing to give it a try.
Right.
Versus another patient who will say, I hear you, but I hate taking pills.
Yep.
And if there's any way I could not take pills, I'd rather not. And then, you know, and everybody, you're focusing on lifestyle. But when you're talking about the medication piece, that's where we're talking about, it gets kind of tough. And I think we need to align with the patient's preference and values and goals. And we need to give them permission to make different choices. I often say two people can make different choices and both be right for them.
Yeah.
They're within a range where the guidelines suggesting this, but other guidelines suggesting that. Let's just say, who are you? Like, what do you want to try given these different approaches? And then we need the language and the tools to help us be able to inform the choice, recognizing that people are never going to become hypertension experts, but they should be able to understand some of the basics about the trade-offs.
Right.
And trade-offs are more pills, but, you know, potentially lower risk, but we can't, you know, there's some uncertainty about that.
Yep.
And depending on who they are, meanwhile, we need to continue to garner more evidence. But I would like to see us tack toward a position. I'd like to see guidelines tack towards, rather than saying 120, I'd rather have them write what we believe now is that 120 is a reasonable option for people who want to take this direction. And those kind of people would tend to value, you know, they don't mind taking extra pills. They're relatively, you know, avid for trying new medical approaches. When new evidence comes out, they want to be one of the first to give it a try.
Yep.
And this person fears this and this, and they don't fear this and this. Or you also have permission to stay with the old one, and that would be people who tend not to want to add meds. They feel they don't want to be continually checking their blood pressure. They don't want to be in the loop of this. And we begin to help, rather than saying, pretending that the average result, and there's a fixed threshold. If you're above 140 or above 130 or above 120, we have to do X, but we try to customize and personalize based on people's preferences, because otherwise what generally happens is we write a script and then people go home and do what they want anyway.
Yeah.
And, you know, this way we can be in tune to say, let's decide together, you know, but the fact that the guideline says 120 means I'm not crazy if I say to you, it's an option. If you want to try to push further down, we can.
Yeah.
You know, and there's at least one guideline that's a very reputable guideline that's suggesting that's what we should do. And then, You know, if I would have done that before without the guideline, I would say I'm totally off the grid here on the guidelines. But, you know, we can try it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I believe this gives permission for us to say, for the right person, this is a good choice. For another person, they might want to stick with the old threshold.
So people are going to have to earn their salaries by doing lots of thinking and talking with each other, as opposed to saying, okay, you're here and we're going to give you this.
And then, so how do we build it in so that the doctors aren't feeling like, gosh, I can't spend another 45 minutes with someone and I'm backed up in my office.
Right.
So we need to be able to develop what kind of workflows are necessary. How do we provide tools and materials when people are sitting in the waiting room? Can they watch a video or can they listen to, you know, a podcast? Or how are we going? We're not prepared yet for this. We're not prepared really to help people be informed in their choices. What we're in a busy day when we have 10 minutes with a patient, we're prepared to go and tell them what to do and walk out the door because we have got a whole range line of people behind them.
Right.
And this is, I think, a challenge to medicine. These are complex decisions. There's not a simple right and wrong. And the truth is the very best decisions will be made with people, not to people. And like I said, we know even after a heart attack, 50% of people stop taking statins within a year. I mean, people aren't bought into the strategies that we're pushing. And I think it's in part because we're not implementing approaches that fully engage them. Yeah. And in part, that's because we don't have time and we don't have the tools. And we're, you know, it's too much to tell the doctors, come on, you know, dig in. You can't do it.
Yeah.
So we need, the whole system needs to flex to figure out how do we help people make these choices? How do we continue to support them? And how do we not put it all on the backs of the doctors?
Okay, well, I think that's good advice. For the meantime, Dr. Krumholz, I want to thank you for talking with me today.
Oh, thanks for the opportunity. It's always good to talk to you.
That was our 223rd edition. All earlier conversations may be found at podcasts.jwatch.org, where you can leave comments on this conversation, or you can contact me on email, jelia@nejm.org. We come to you from Journal Watch. Kristen Kelly is the executive producer here for the NEJM Group. I'm Joe Elia. Thank you for listening.